You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. You might think that the whole world is already mapped out. You can look at any spot on the entire planet using Google Earth, right? Not quite, say our guests on today's show, who were part of a mission that found an entire city buried deep in a remote jungle. Stay with us. Did you know the first computers were not invented by human beings, but by nature? On Tuesday, October 22nd, at the Lensic, scientist Jessica Flack will talk about how nature computes, from cells to neurons to bees to humans. This free talk, The Collective Computation of Reality in Nature and Society, is part of the Santa Fe Institute's Community Lecture Series. Reserve your free seats at ticketssantafe.org. Support for the Radio Cafe comes from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a reading and conversation by Deborah Levy with Jonathan Freeman on Wednesday, October 30th at 7 o'clock at the Lensic. Deborah Levy is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and writes fiction, plays, and poetry. The author of beloved books including Hot Milk and Swimming Home, both Man Booker Prize finalists, and Things I Don't Want to Know, her latest novel is The Man Who Saw Everything, longlisted for the 2019 Booker Prize. Tickets available at the Lensic, 988-1234, or lensic.org. I'd like now to welcome Steve Elkins. He's co-producer of the film The Lost City of the Monkey God. He was expedition leader of the group that found this city. And we're joined by Doug Preston, journalist and author of the book by the same name, Lost City of the Monkey God. He co-wrote the film's narration, and both of them are in the film as well. And the film will be screened at the Violet Crown Cinema here in Santa Fe on Wednesday, October 23rd at 5:30. It's a benefit for the School for Advanced Research. There will be another screening on Sunday, October 27th at 2 in the afternoon, also at the Violet Crown. Welcome, Steve Elkins and Doug Preston, to the Radio Cafe.
Very happy to be here, Mary Charlotte.
Great to be here.
So the film and the book are about this 2015 excursion to Honduras to find a lost city, an archaeological ruin, which in Honduran legend is called La Ciudad Blanca, or the White City. Steve, your interest in this site goes back decades. How did you first hear about this legend, and what was known about the site before this current set of explorations?
Well, I was in the film and television business back in the 90s, and it was what I call a contract producer. I was interested in producing a show of my own rather than producing programs for others. And I put the word out on the street, so to speak, if anybody had any good ideas. And I was introduced to a adventurer, treasure hunter, raconteur character named Captain Steve Morgan, because like in the room. And he had written 50 short little stories about expeditions he had done or wanted to do. And one of them was about this fabled lost city in the jungles of Honduras. I read it, fell in love with it right away. And Steve told me, by the way, I'm looking for it myself. And I got a good buddy, Bruce, who can make all the arrangements. And why don't we go and do that? And we can make a TV show about it. I said, great, let's go. And we did. That was 1994.
And what did you find?
Well, we had quite an adventure for a few weeks. I had never done a trip like that in the jungle before, so I wasn't quite sure what I'd be getting into. But it was very exciting. And while we were there, we saw a lot of artifacts and things we ran into, but no city. However, at one point, we were high up in the mountains, days walk from any human habitation, alongside this river. And there was this pretty large boulder with a wonderful carving of a man with a mask or a hat on. It looked like a stick of some sort and a sack with some seeds or something coming out of it. And I immediately had an epiphany and said, here we are in this rainforest. You can't see 20 feet in front of you. What's a carving like this of a person looks like perhaps they're planting seeds or something doing in a place like this? There had to be something going on in the past that's not evident by the environment that we were in now. At that moment, I became obsessed with trying to prove or disprove the legend.
Doug, let's talk about the legend for a moment. I mean, this legend of the lost city, the white city, is this something that all Hondurans know about? Like, what is the place of this legend in the Honduran psyche?
Well, it is something that's sort of part of the Honduran national psyche in the similar way that the legend of El Dorado is part of the Colombian psyche and so forth. It's a story that most kids in Honduras know about. And, you know, there's always been discussions, is it real, is it mythical? But it's part of the Honduran national consciousness. And in fact, the story goes back 500 years to the time of Cortez, to one of the letters he wrote to the Emperor of Spain during his exploration of the coastline of Honduras. And he said he'd received very reliable reports of extremely rich provinces in the interior of Honduras with gold and silver and cities and so on and so forth. But he wasn't able to explore them because they were too remote and he had other things to do. So that story and other stories from early Spanish explorers that were similar were passed down in the generations and also seemed to be combined with indigenous stories in Honduras of a similar sort, of a city, a great city that existed in the jungle where a series of disasters occurred and the people left, leaving everything there, and it was then cursed, and anyone who finds the city or stumbles across it will die or be lost in the jungle forever. So all these legends were rolled up together, and in the 1930s, this area was starting to be explored just a little bit by anthropologists who then recorded many of these stories from their indigenous informants, from people they met, about this great lost city. So it was taken seriously. The anthropologists and archaeologists actually felt that these legends are often based on the truth. So there was a very legitimate search for this great ruin.
The key, as people who read the book or watch the movie know or will find out, is what's called LIDAR technology. What is LIDAR and how is it affecting the practice of archaeology and, like, specifically finding this particular site?
Well, it's a revolution. It's an evolution and a revolution. When I heard about airborne LIDAR, which is the version of LIDAR technology used from an aircraft, it was tested actually in Belize at the Maya site of Caracol in late 2009 by some archaeologists who just were doing a science experiment basically to see if it would work. And it worked fabulous. They were able to see things in the surrounding jungle in Belize that would have taken them 100 years to be able to survey by foot. I read their report in 2010, and I said, you know, this is the only way. This is the future of finding things like lost cities. Walking with a machete, the blind leading the blind through the jungles for the birds, that's old school. Now you're going to fly in an airplane, you're going to scan a large area, and you're going to be able to actually see what's on the ground. So it hadn't been proven yet that it would work in a jungle as dense as the one we found in eastern Honduras, but it was worth a shot. And when we did it, it worked great. I mean, the engineers weren't even sure it was going to work, but they were happy to try as long as I paid them. But it worked beyond everyone's expectations. The results were fantastic. And now it's really the survey method du jour for every archaeologist everywhere in the world. And incredible discoveries are being made every day.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it works kind of like sonar in the sense that a pulse, but a laser pulse, is sent out, goes through the vegetation and bounces back off of the hard materials like the rocks, and therefore you can get like a whole sense of what's under the vegetation. Is that more or less correct?
That's pretty close. What it does is it actually bounces back from the leaves and the trees and the plants. You get a data set of everything. But with the software that the scientists have developed, you can filter out what you don't want. So you say, I only want to look what's really on the surface or within 1 or 2 feet of the surface. Then you can keep on going higher and higher. And you filter out the leaves and the tree trunks and the ferns and everything else until all you're looking at are the undulations or the elevation changes in the ground. And if there's buildings or earthworks or man-made structures that were buried, they leave an impression. There's a slight variation in the elevation of the ground, and that's what you see. And that's what we saw. We could see the shape of a pyramid. We could see the shape of plazas, of waterworks and house foundations and a variety of things.
And so all of that was incredibly exciting and led to the mission in 2015 that you document in the film and in the book. And this mission comprised scientists and filmmakers, writers, as well as the logistics people, military people guarding the whole thing. How were you guys trained to be safe in this totally remote and uninhabited, well, uninhabited by people, part of the jungle?
Well, actually, I just called. I called up Doug and said, "Doug, you're in charge of all that. You're going to keep us safe, right?"
Yeah, you wish. But no, actually, Steve and his group managed to find a company based in England, run by former SAS military soldiers, who were experts in jungle warfare, and they now have a company that takes film crews into some of the most dangerous and violent and extreme areas of the world. So they organized this expedition, and they pretty much told us, here's how it's going to be. And we had three of these British guys who really set the terms, organized the expedition from the logistics point of view, were able to organize the security for it because it did require security. And we were also working in cooperation with the Honduran government and their military, in particular, their special forces. So we had a military component as well. Obviously, this was a joint Honduran-American expedition. And the Hondurans were very excited by this discovery because, of course, it was part of their national heritage, their patrimony.
And they were saying, I mean, that this British company was saying things, I mean, I can't remember exactly how it was, but basically, listen very carefully to what we're about to say, because if not, you're going to die.
Yes. They gave us a lecture in the beginning. We had arrived in Honduras and we were staying in Catacamas, and they gave us this lecture that was scared the hell out of all of us. And the whole time I was thinking, oh, you know, they're just exaggerating the dangers. You know, I've done a lot of backpacking in my life. Steve probably felt the same way. You know, they're just exaggerating all this for the benefit of people who haven't been in an extreme environment before. But when we actually got into the jungle and saw what we were facing and saw the extreme and difficult and dangerous environment we were in, not just because of the weather, the thickness of the jungle, but also because of the animals, the poisonous snakes, the jaguars, mountain lions, pumas, wildlife down there. It was much more dangerous than they had led us to believe.
Yeah. I actually recall, it rained a lot, obviously, because we're in a rainforest, sitting in my tent, which was not far from Doug's, and listening to the pounding rain, looking at the mud that surrounded everything. We're all soaking wet. We could hear the animals walking around. We couldn't even get helicopters in and out because it's raining so hard. So we're totally isolated. I'm going, what the heck am I doing here? And why did I bring all these people to this place?
Right,
but now
right.
I'm liable for everybody.
Well, when we arrived, the animals had never seen people before. And I remember when Steve and I set up our little camps, it was under a big tree, and there was a huge population, a group of spider monkeys living in the tree. And they were very upset at our arrival. And so they came down and they were shaking branches at us and screeching and trying to drive us off. And when they couldn't drive us off, they all lined up on these branches and just watched us for hours. At one point they were eating flowers. It looked like popcorn. And I thought to myself, I wonder who's in the zoo now.
Right. Very interesting. Tell us just a little bit about what it was like when you got there, because there's things that a documentary and a book can tell us, but there's something about, like, I was just trying to imagine, you know, the temperature, the smell, the feel of the place.
Well, I've never been in a place that was so absolutely untouched by the human presence. I mean, again, animals that had never seen people, but also that was completely indifferent to our human presence and really hostile to us. I mean, it turned out like the very first night, I was walking in the dark, you know, back from my hammock, and my flashlight revealed the presence of a gigantic fer-de-lance snake, highly aroused, in striking position. He'd been tracking me. He was huge. And these snakes are the most poisonous snakes in the New World. They are 600 times more poisonous than a rattlesnake. If you get bitten by a fer-de-lance, if you don't die right away, your life is changed forever. Usually the limb that it strikes has to be amputated. So I called out, "Hey, you guys, there's a big snake here." So these three British guys rushed over, and the lead guy said, "Oh, blimey," he said, "I think we better move it." And I thought to myself, move it? How the hell is he going to move this snake? But he cut a 7-foot snake stick. It was forked at the end. He pinned the snake, and then it just exploded in a fury of striking every which way and venom spewing from its fangs. I mean, you could see these arcs of venom going through the night air. We all had our flashlights on it. And he worked the stick up behind the snake's head, grabbed it, but the snake, in trying to bite him, was swiveling its head around and expelled venom all over the back of his hand, and his skin was starting to bubble. So he wrestled the snake to the ground. The snake was bigger than he was, and cut off its head. And that wasn't the end of the struggle. The headless snake continued to struggle, and the head of the snake snapped and spewed venom until he took his knife and stabbed it into the ground.
Oh, my goodness.
And then...
And that's why we hired those guys.
Yeah. Well, it was funny because he washed his hands, and he said, "Nothing like that to concentrate the mind, is there?"
I mean, these people who could do stuff like that are awe-inspiring. And it's interesting, I mean, the way you're saying about these places that where the animals have not encountered humans. Well, I mean, you did find this, and we'll talk about it in a moment. You did find these archaeological ruins. And I found myself wondering how the people who lived there before got there. I mean, was the terrain very different? How old was that site? And what was it like before it was just covered with this rainforest?
Well, those are all excellent questions, and the archaeologists and anthropologists have now been working there for 4 years, going on 5, trying to figure that out, because it turns out that the culture that was living there was essentially unknown to science. Nobody really knew who they were, and they've been, over the last 2 years, figuring out more and more about them. And in fact, we all speculated, been abandoned about 500 years ago at the time of the European conquest, because that's when a lot of sites like that became abandoned. And that's in the time since then, they've done 11 carbon dates. And they found that the youngest one was 14 or 1500 years old. And the oldest one to date is 3,600 years old. So this site has been inhabited for thousands of years. And they're still, I mean, it'll take them a long time to figure out, just, was it the same culture? Was it many cultures? Did they all, was it inhabited continuously or off and on? We don't know. One thing we do know, though, is when there's a large population there, it's not the same rainforest as we see now. As we all are aware of climate change, the world is dynamic. It's always changing. People modify the environment. This is nothing new. We just do it to a greater degree now than we used to in the past. So things change and people adapt. We really don't know exactly what it was like when these people lived there. And someday we might.
Well, the interesting thing about the geography of this site is that it's a valley of about 20 square miles, completely surrounded by gigantic, almost impenetrable mountains with only one point of access. And so that it provided a natural fortress-like environment to found a city. And so it isn't at all surprising, and in fact, I think Steve can tell you that it was the geography of it that originally attracted him. It isn't at all surprising that people would settle there because it's such a naturally defensible site. Steve, maybe you should talk about how you identified that valley, because that's a really interesting story.
Yeah, it is very, actually, it is important too. And as Doug said, it's this isolated valley surrounded by these high, steep mountains with only one chasm with a river in it as access. So it's very strategic. And it actually reminded me of the old movie Lost Horizons or Lost Worlds. You know, there was an old movie about going up in the Himalayas to this hidden valley where people live forever, or there's dinosaurs or something. That's what it reminded me of. And the way I found it is back in the mid-90s, I had contracted an engineer at the Jet Propulsion Lab out here in California to use the best available satellite technology at the time to scan the area with different wavelengths and different sensors to see if we could see any ruins through the jungle canopy. Well, at the time, the technology was not available to see through the canopy, but we did produce incredibly detailed topographic images of the terrain. And it struck me almost instantly. We saw this valley, this kidney-shaped valley with this ring of mountains around it. And I went, wow, this is like right out of a movie. If I was a king back in the day, this is where I'd put my kingdom. It was kind of flat on the inside, a couple of small, modest-sized rivers, very strategic, easy to defend, probably has a microclimate, all the ingredients you'd want to put in a kingdom of some sort that you could thrive in and also defend. So that became my primary target, which I called, for purposes of our expedition, T1 or Target 1.
Which, in fact, was correct.
It was. It was a good guess, huh?
Well, I mean, as you're saying, more than a good guess. I mean, you're putting things together like a detective. And once you're there on the ground, you know, you, Doug, some archaeologists, all these different people, you've got the LIDAR map, which is on a kind of sophisticated GPS system. And you're looking at, you know, you're basically looking at a pyramid, but you're not seeing the pyramid. You're just seeing like trees and vegetation. What was the moment where the first evidence of the lost city was seen?
Well, we did see everything we saw on the LIDAR. We had the LIDAR maps. The LIDAR images were loaded onto like a looked like a giant cell phone, like a giant GPS cell phone device. And that's how we navigated through the jungle, because literally you couldn't see 20 feet in front of you. You had to hack your way through it. Our lead archaeologist, Dr. Chris Fisher, had this device, and we would just follow the cursor. It would say, like, you know, 50 meters to the pyramid. And we'd walk over there, hack our way through it. And all of a sudden, Chris would say, well, there's the pyramid in front of us. And I remember going, where? Because all you could see was the ground went up. And you just thought, okay, this is another hill I have to walk up. But they had no idea it was a pyramid because it's so covered in trees and vegetation. But yet there it was in the LIDAR. And when we mapped it out, you could see, yes, it was a pyramid. And it was like that with all the different structures. We would not have found them had we not had the LIDAR telling us where to go. It would say, make a left to go to the plaza. And we'd make a left, and we'd go so much distance, and all of a sudden there'd be some stone walls. Okay, there's the perimeter of the plaza. But after doing that for a while, and Doug says it very succinctly in the movie and the book, you go, is that all there is? You know, like, okay, we need something a little more exciting here. And fortunately, our cameraman, Lucian Reed, was behind us in a group. We were walking back and forth and back and forth one day in the rain and all getting kind of discouraged that we didn't find anything more spectacular. Not that this wasn't. And all of a sudden he yells, hey, I just tripped on some weird looking rocks. And ran over there and he went, holy cow, these are artifacts. These are some rocks. And we all ran over. And actually Doug was the first one who ran down and said, look, there's inscriptions on this rock. And then bedlam ensued. Everybody went crazy. And our lead archaeologist, I think, kind of lost his cool. He tried to put police tape everywhere and tell us to walk away. Well, of course, we're not going to walk away. We just spent all this money and all this time trying to find something like this. And it turned out there were 52 beautifully carved stone objects, bowls and vases incised with inscriptions and images and sculptures of animal heads and so on and so forth. Oh, we all went berserk.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We'll be back in half a minute. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is once again accepting scholarship applications, and Northern New Mexico residents are invited to apply. Deadline for undergraduate scholarships is the 21st of January, 2020. Deadline for Career Pathways Scholarships in support of two-year degrees, certificates, and trades is November 17th, 2019. Criteria and application for both may be found at lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. Well, one of the things that's so interesting about this film and about this whole story is that there are cultural differences among the people there. I don't mean ethnic differences, but I mean the difference in cultures between, you know, filmmakers and journalists on the one hand and archaeologists and scientists on the other. You, Steve, the filmmaker, you know, you're responsible for the discovery of this site. And, you know, you guys were the ones who actually found and recognized those first artifacts. That seemed to kind of irk the archaeologists. And then when you were talking about it, both in that first moment and after you came back, some real conflicts arose. Describe for us some of the issues that came up both during the expedition and then afterwards when you, Doug, wrote a short article for National Geographic describing what you saw.
Well, it is true that this was a controversial discovery. It irked some archaeologists. The expedition had 10 PhD scientists with it, including several archaeologists, an anthropologist, engineers, botanists, ethnobotanists, and so forth. So we were very well equipped to understand what we were finding. But there were several archaeologists who were not part of the expedition who felt disgruntled, a little bit left out, and they started a drumbeat of complaint, saying that, oh, it's just a bunch of filmmakers sensationalizing this. It's not that important a discovery, and so on and so forth. And when the National Geographic article came out, they complained again, saying, oh, it's been sensationalized. But my response to that is, it is sensational. There's no sensationalization going on here. This is a truly important and spectacular archaeological discovery, and it was done correctly. Now, one of these archaeologists had a beef with the fact that the city was not discovered by archaeologists, but by LIDAR engineers. And they didn't like that because they were old school and felt that LIDAR was really a tool that archaeology shouldn't be using because it's too expensive and because it's engineers and not archaeologists. But they have been left behind by history. Now, as Steve was saying earlier, LIDAR is now probably the number one tool that archaeologists are using all over the world, making incredible discoveries. And one of the most wonderful things about it is that you can map an entire city from the air. You don't even have to touch anything on the ground. It's a completely
non-invasive,
exactly, way of mapping a city without even setting foot into it. So it's a wonderful thing from that point of view because it preserves everything. But after the book came out and after the true dimensions of the discovery became known, these complaining archaeologists fell silent.
Well, one of the things that was interesting was a conversation that you all filmed of whether a few objects should be taken back in the helicopter and shown, both for the purposes of demonstrating what was there and for fundraising and things like that. And the archaeologist was, and the various archaeologists were adamant that those things shouldn't be moved, even, and they were willing to run the risk of the possibility of looting, since the site was then known and identified. People could have come in and stolen stuff.
That was a very tense moment. It was a difficult, you know, I obviously, it's clear what I wanted to do, and it's clear what the archaeologists wanted to do, which was the right way to go. In the end, we probably did the right thing by leaving it alone and coming back, but only because we were quickly able to get an excavation expedition organized within 6 months.
Yeah, well, and also they left the military there guarding the site.
We were very fortunate that the president of Honduras at the time stepped up to the plate and understood how important this was for his country, and he assigned the military to guard the site until we could come back.
You know, what this whole story or this part of the story makes me think about is, I mean, everybody these days is complaining about how everyone's in their silos and they need to talk to each other more and be more interdisciplinary. And in something like this, it's so clear that, you know, the filmmakers and the archaeologists need each other. I mean, the filmmakers can't do archaeology, but the archaeologists, if you rely on their writing to communicate with the general public, nothing will ever be known because they use incomprehensible jargon that can only be understood by other academics. So they need you guys to put the story out into the world.
Well, that's right. The movie, the documentary is really remarkable. I mean, it's actually a wonderful thing that there are cameras there actually recording the discovery as it was made, recording the discussions, the disputes, everything. I mean, this is a really important documentary because it really looks at the process of science, how things are done, instead of sort of presenting something as a, oh, here's what we found, which is how most documentaries work. You know, here's what we found, as if all this information was handed to us from on high, this documentary really shows the nitty-gritty of it, the dangers that the archaeologists face, the disputes they have, the disagreements, and so forth. It's a wonderful glimpse of how archaeology actually works. And a very important, I think, from an historical point of view, documenting this really wonderful discovery.
Well, I think, Mary Charlotte, you are also very cognizant in saying the interdisciplinary approach is extraordinarily important. I purposely put together scientists from different fields because I knew that's what it takes to try and understand and make these things work. It's not just one particular field. You know, sometimes that creates a little chaos and some problems. And my job as a leader was to try and keep the team together. Even if I may personally have not agreed with everything, I had to look at the bigger picture. None of the scientists would have had the opportunity to see this or to work on this had not my partner Bill and I organized this expedition. And had not people like Doug wrote about it, so we were able to get the money to organize it. So there's a lot of things going on. It's almost, you know, I remember when I was younger, people would say, you know, people would say, when you're younger, what are you going to do with your life? And some people went in sales. They were just naturally good talkers. And sometimes people would sort of put down the profession of being a salesperson. But I always thought, you know, somebody's got to sell the concept. Someone has to sell the idea. In our case, I guess being filmmakers and writers, we sold the idea. We made it happen. Without us, none of the scientists would be doing anything.
Yeah. And then, you know, what's happened in an interdisciplinary way in the Valley since then has been quite remarkable. Conservation International was very interested in the Valley. They realized it was an extremely rare, unspoiled environment, and they sent a rapid response team down there to look at the ecology of the Valley, and they made remarkable discoveries. They found all these species that they thought were extinct or almost extinct were living there in abundance. They found tremendous diversity of big cats and all kinds of very rare large mammals and so forth. In fact, at one point, the head of that expedition, he went out at night to, I guess he was going to photograph some glass frogs or something. And he was about, 500 or 600 yards from camp. And he was taking a leak, sorry. And all of a sudden, this huge puma, this mountain lion, just walked right up to him and crouched and stared at him. And was looking at him, and he said, I knew what was going through his head. It was food or not food. And he said, I just stood there and stared at him, and for the longest time, these human and puma stared at each other, and finally the puma decided, maybe not food, maybe this one isn't going to taste too good, and got up and walked off into the darkness. And then the scientist hurried back to camp. He was really freaked out, thinking, at any moment this puma's going to jump him out of the darkness. He got back to camp and they said, hey, your fly's unzipped.
Oh my goodness.
He'd forgotten to zip up his fly. He was so startled. But that's just an example of the sort of encounters that they had with these giant cats. I mean, there's tremendous diversity of rare mammals down there.
Well, and that's a kind of interesting, positive, unintended consequence of this whole thing, was that it became a really consciously preserved conservation area.
Exactly.
Exactly. The Honduran government recognizes how important this area is. I think they recognize it from an economic point of view, that there's, you know, a lot of the jungle has been lost in Central America, and this area of Honduras is the largest unspoiled area of jungle probably in the entirety of Central America. And the Honduran government, I think, realizes that this could be a very important thing for them economically, perhaps, for ecotourism. It should be preserved as is and not developed and the rainforest not cut and cleared for things like logging or cattle ranching.
In fact, the conservation movement in Honduras has gathered a lot of steam. And within the last year, a foundation was formed called the Caja Camasa Foundation. Caja Camasa means Ciudad Blanca or White City in the local Pech language. And there are many people, in fact, the former Ministry of Science and Technology is heading it up and a bunch of other people, that are working very hard to make conservation happen. And in fact, The foundation is kind of a consortium, and we brought in three major NGOs from the United States: Conservation International, as Doug said, Wildlife Conservation Society out of the Bronx, which runs the Bronx Zoo. They've been around 100 years. And Global Wildlife Conservation out of Austin, Texas. They've been spending people down there for over the last year working with locals and with the government to try and come up with strategies and real-world plans to save this forest. And one of the things they found out is that, as Doug alluded, not only is this probably the most biodiverse place left in Central America, it's also the heart of the wildlife corridor between the Americas. So if this jungle fails, there'll be a series of ecological catastrophes, of which we really don't know the results of, but there will be failures and many species will be lost. So it's not just something Honduras has to worry about. This is a global problem. And there are many areas in the world, there aren't that many areas left, and this is one of them. And it's highly critical that this area not be deforested if we want life the way we like it.
Yeah, and the point is that this excavation, the discovery of this lost city, actually aids in the preservation of the forest. Is that right?
It did. I mean, that's actually the most important result, I think, of this entire project, was that the discovery of the city triggered all this tremendously effective conservation effort, because the deforestation in that area had been nibbling away at the rainforest. Well, nibbling is not the word. It had been eating away at the rainforest for decades, for cattle ranching. There was illegal settlement and all the rest of it. And this discovery caused the Honduran government to put a stop to that. And they've even been moving and evicting some of the people who've been illegally settling there. So this rainforest would not have been preserved if it hadn't been for this discovery.
Very, very interesting. So what happened was, now this area has been excavated, and I was thinking about that big argument about whether to take a few objects out, and the archaeologists were adamant that they shouldn't be taken out. In fact, they were left there. But then later in the film, you show objects being taken out and shown in a museum. Why was it okay later and not before?
Well, it's because 6 months after that initial foray ground expedition, we put together a team, a joint Honduran-American group, to go in there for a month and start formal excavations. So a team of archaeologists, a whole bunch of them, came down there and they did formal excavations, which lasted a month. And they've been doing that ever since then for the last four, going on 5 years, where they'll go in for several weeks at a time. In fact, there's a group going in on the day that we're showing the movie in Santa Fe. There's a whole nother group of archaeologists going down to continue the work, because they can only stay there so long because it's tough work and the weather's bad and so on and so forth. But that's what goes on. And those objects, once they are cataloged in the proper scientific method, they are removed. And the government built a museum just outside the jungle near the town of Catacamas, where they go into an archive, into a lab, and they're curated and they're cataloged and studied. And then some are put on display in the museum right there, or maybe sometimes they go to Tegucigalpa, to the capital city, for a special exhibition. And that's the plan. The objects keep on going. I think there's around 600 artifacts so far that are in that museum, and it'll continue to grow. They're finding new stuff all the time.
And they're beautiful and stimulate the imagination to really contemplate how these people lived. What do we know about them at this point, Doug, about how they did live, what they did?
Well, these people were living adjacent to the great Maya Empire, or reign. The area wasn't necessarily an empire, but the site is about 200 miles east of Copan. And it's quite clear that these people, even though they were not Maya, they were greatly influenced by the Maya. And it appears that at the time of the collapse of Copan, there was a great influx of people into this city, perhaps from Copan, because it looks like they built a ball court, it seems. They started to play that famous Maya ball game that was so violent, and the losers sometimes were executed, lost their heads. And the city itself is laid out in a vaguely Maya fashion, and some of the inscriptions on the objects that were found might be Maya sky bands, which were sort of representations of the heavens that the Maya used as sort of a geometrical representations. But they were not Maya themselves. They certainly engaged in trade with the Maya because there was a lot of cacao trees in this jungle, wild cacao trees, and chocolate was a very important trade item. To the Maya, chocolate was actually sacred. It was a drink that was used in ceremonies, and it was considered to be a food of the gods. And so it's quite clear that this area was probably trading cacao, macaws, and other objects of great value with the Maya. So there's a lot of going back and forth. But that's pretty much all we know about them, except that we do believe that they really modified the jungle quite remarkably to create an almost Garden of Eden-like atmosphere where the open areas, beautiful view lines to the pyramids with flower gardens, because we know that flowers were a very important part of their ceremonies, with house mounds connected by roads and fields intermixed with the houses. This was not a super dense settlement like Copan. It was more like L.A. instead of New York. So it was fairly spread out, and there were a lot of outlying farms connected by roads and terracing and things like that. So it was actually, at the time people were living there, it was quite a beautiful and livable environment. Of course, as soon as the city was abandoned, the jungle came roaring back, and there's really been no one in the valley probably since the city was abandoned at least 500 years ago.
Do we know if there are traces of roads? I mean, you talked about trading with the Mayans.
Well, the LIDAR showed the presence of what looked like some roads, but they're hard to trace. The Maya roads are very, very striking, but that's in a jungle that's much more open. I mean, it was still jungle, but it isn't quite as heavy as this jungle, and also the terrain is flatter where Copan is. This is a really rugged terrain, so there hasn't been any work done on tracing roads.
With that said, I do want to say that for a number of years with satellites and so on, and even more with LIDAR, we know that there are paved roads, not paved with asphalt, but they take flat stones. They make a road bed by raising the dirt and then putting the stones on them. And those roads extend all the way from where you are in New Mexico, in the Four Corners area, all the way to northern South America. There are segments of those roads. So one can almost imagine a giant ancient Pan-American highway, perhaps not in one continuous line, but people had these cleared areas that they could easily walk on and transport themselves. So there was a lot of active transportation and people going back and forth throughout the Americas in ancient times. We're learning more and more about that as our remote sensing technology gets better. But as Doug said, trying to find that in the jungle where we were, you could find little bits and pieces, but not big sections like you have in some of the flatter Maya areas.
At the beginning of our conversation, we were talking about how ordinary Hondurans know this legend of the White City. How did they react to this discovery?
Well, it was quite a spectacular reaction. There was huge headlines all over the country reporting on this. There were cabinet meetings with the Honduran government where this information was shared out. I think Steve went down to the palace, the presidential palace, and to Tegucigalpa to take part in a very large press conference, which really astonished and thrilled everyone in Honduras about this discovery. So it's a big deal. Hondurans know a lot about their Spanish history. You know, it's a country with two histories. You know, it's a mestizo country. They have a history from Europe, from Spain, and then they have an indigenous history. And the European history is well known and well documented, but the indigenous history is somewhat mysterious. It hasn't really been completely pieced together. And so this discovery really was important for Hondurans to understand their past and to explore their cultural patrimony in the New World going back before the European contact.
One of the things that I think was an interesting conversation in the documentary was there were archaeologists who objected to, you know, the whole way the discovery was made. And one thing that they talked about was you can't say it's discovery if indigenous people knew about it all along. You know, the whole kind of nonsensical idea that Columbus discovered America when there were already people there and so on. Where does this story sit with respect to that? I mean, are there indigenous people who had a heritage or a set of myths or stories about the white city, or were they just too far away from this very dense jungle area?
We did get some criticism about that, and people said, oh, you know, the local indigenous people, even though they weren't living in the area we were, they knew about this. This was part of their history. And it's true. They did have legends about the lost city, the Pesh people in particular. And so it's the Tawaka and the Mosquito. The legends have been around for a long time. However, some people said, oh, yeah, we know where it is. And many explorers had gone in past years with them as guides, and they never really found it. Or they, you know, found some other place, or they don't really know what they found. But there was no real cohesive storyline here. Now, just recently, in the last few months, the Hondurans, who have been doing a lot of work and research, they got the Cacique de Cacique, who's the king of kings of the Pesh people. He's the Pesh elder. So he's the Mucky Mucka, the Pesh, who are the people who we believe are the descendants of people who live there. And they brought him out to the site. And there's a video that you can actually see on Facebook, at the Caja Camasa Foundation Facebook page, where he is there with some officials from Honduras, and he is speaking part in Pesh and part in Spanish, saying that he had heard about this place his whole life, his grandparents, his great-grandparents. They all knew that this place existed, but nobody knew exactly where it was. He never thought in his life that he would ever see this. Nobody knew about this place. And he's breaking down in tears, holding his hand on his heart and putting his other hand on the heart of one of the Honduran officials. And the both of them are almost in tears as he's describing just how wonderful it is for this moment that he and his people seeing this place of their ancestors that nobody had any idea was there. So when I saw that, I went, any of our critics who are saying that the indigenous people knew where this was are full of malarkey. Because here's the head guy saying, wait, we had no idea. And it was thrilled to be there.
Very interesting. This is a story about a lot of different things. One of the things that happened is that you contracted a tropical disease called leishmaniasis. It's a flesh-eating parasite. And in this case, it was a strain that was unique to this area that you were in. And because of that, humans had no natural defenses to it because they'd never been exposed to it before. And more than half of the expedition got it, including the Hondurans who were there with you. What was that like, and how did you deal with it?
Well, it was one of those things I'll never forget. After we got out of the jungle, Steve and I were sitting by the pool in Catacamas drinking a cold beer. And Steve wiped his brow and said, thank God we got out of there. And nobody was killed, nobody was injured, and nobody got sick. It's a miracle. Well, his relief was premature, because about 3 or 4 months after the end of the expedition, you know, you come out of the jungle completely covered with bug bites, and it takes a few months for them to go away. Some of them really are persistent. But after about 2 months, a number of people noticed that there was a bug bite that wasn't going away, but was getting worse. And a lot worse. And many of us went to the doctors, and they said, well, it looks like an infection, and you get a course of antibiotics or whatever, but it wouldn't help. And this bug bite then turned into a horrible lesion. And it was actually the National Geographic photographer who'd been with us, who is a bit of a hypochondriac, but he was Googling around trying to figure out what it was. And he said, uh-oh, it looks like leishmaniasis. And so I looked at the pictures of leishmaniasis, and of course I was completely horrified. I do not advise your listeners to Google leishmaniasis and look at the pictures. It's absolutely horrible.
But if you want to, we can spell it for you.
But so it turned out that this valley was a hot zone of this very horrible disease. And so the National Institutes of Health was quite interested in the fact that we'd all gotten leishmaniasis in this one little area, and they are working, they're the world's premier institution, you know, investigating the disease and trying to develop a vaccine. So they invited all of us down there for free medical care. They even paid our airfare and put us up in a hotel so that they could study us. So we all got very good treatment down there. But unfortunately, it's a disease that is essentially incurable. The treatment just beats down the disease. It doesn't really cure you. And the treatment itself is quite horrible. But it's a very interesting disease. So I wrote about that in my book.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing very well. There are some others who've had some real struggles, had to undergo multiple treatments, really, really rigorous treatments. The Honduran archaeologist with us was very severely affected by it, unfortunately. But, you know, anytime you make a wonderful discovery, it's not easy. I mean, there's a reason why this city remained undiscovered, and the dangerousness and toughness of that jungle is really what has prevented that city from being found before now.
And kept it pristine with all these incredible, I mean, there were some nature cameras that were put up so that people weren't taking pictures. They were just automatically taking pictures when wildlife walked by, and incredible pictures of just droves of these mammals and different creatures, peccaries, as you say, different kinds of felines. And I think one of the things that's so interesting about this story is that it's a story about exploration itself. And you guys really talk about the fact that, you know, we think that the whole world has been mapped down to the last square inch and that we know everything. And it's not true at all.
It is amazing that you could find a lost city in the 21st century. But that's exactly what happened.
Well, and I give a lot of lectures, and I always say this towards the end of my speech, and particularly to younger people, you know, saying exactly what you guys just said. Well, we think everything's been discovered and we've been everywhere. But no, it's actually, in my opinion, we're entering the greatest period of discovery in human history because of the evolution of remote sensing technology. We're able to see things we could not even imagine just a few short years ago, from our past, from our present, and into the future. And it's just a whole new ballgame. A million things to be discovered. We don't even know what's out there.
Steve Elkins and Doug Preston, you are going to be there at the screening at the Violet Crown on October 23rd, and you'll be joined by Javier Suazo. Who is he? And tell us about this kind of discussion that's going to happen after the film.
Well, Javier is one of the principals of he's the secretary of the Caja Camasa Foundation, which is this foundation we started last year to manage the archaeological work and the conservation work in the area. He is also very involved in everything that happens there. So he is coming up and will be available to anybody who wants to ask him questions about what's going on there. He's fully bilingual, so it's very easy to talk to him in Spanish or English. And he's a great guy, and I think people will enjoy speaking to him.
Steve Elkins and Doug Preston, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been great.
Steve Elkins and Doug Preston will both be at the screening of the film Lost City of the Monkey God on Wednesday, October 23rd at 5:30 at the Violet Crown Cinema here in Santa Fe, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. There's another screening on Sunday, October 27th at 2 in the afternoon. For more information, sarweb.org. And the Radio Cafe would like to thank its sponsors, Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, the Santa Fe Institute, the Lannan Foundation, the Lenzic Performing Arts Center, and the Southwest Care Center. Thank you all so much. We couldn't do it without you. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.